The moment I heard how Makara died, I should have walked away. I should have finished my drink and left. But he was such a good storyteller, Rick, that once he'd started talking, there was never any question I wouldn't listen. And by the time he'd finished, I was hooked. The story, as Rick told it to me over lunch that day, went like this. Makara had caught the last ferry from Woods Hole, Massachusetts, to Martha's Vineyard 2 Sundays ago. A gale had been blowing since mid-afternoon and the last few crossings had been cancelled. But towards 9 o'clock, the wind eased slightly, and at 9:45, the master decided it was safe to cast off. The boat was crowded, and Makara was lucky to get a space for his car. He parked below decks and then went upstairs to get some air. No one saw him alive again. It was nearly 11 when the ferryman landed Vineyard Haven, and the car started up, all except one, a brand-new tan-colored Ford Escape SUV. When the owner didn't show, the crew tried the doors, which turned out to be unlocked, and freewheeled the big Ford down to the quayside. A police check on the Ford's license plate revealed it to be registered to one Martin S. Reinhardt of New York City. "This is the Marty Reinhardt," I interrupted. "This is he." Reinhardt immediately confirmed over the telephone to the police that the Ford belonged to him. He kept it at his house on Martha's Vineyard for the use of himself and his guest in the summer. He also confirmed that, despite the time of year, a group of people were staying at the moment. A local woman found the body early the next morning, thrown up on the beach about 4 miles down the island's coast at Lambert's Cove. The driver's license in the wallet confirmed him to be Michael James Makara, age 50, from Balham in South London. The police took his corpse to the little morgue in Vineyard Haven and then drove over to the Reinhardt residence to break the news and to fetch one of the other guests to identify him. "Well, it must have been quite a scene," said Rick, when the volunteer guest finally showed up to view the body. There was one patrol car from Edgartown with a blue flashing light, a second car with 4 armed guards to secure the building, and a third vehicle, bombproof, carrying the instantly recognizable man who, until 18 months earlier, had been the Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. What on earth was an ex-Prime Minister doing identifying the body of a man from Balham who fell off the Martha's Vineyard ferry, I said. "Michael Makara," announced Rick with the emphatic delivery of a man who has flown 3,000 miles to deliver this punchline, "was helping him write his memoirs." And this is where, in that parallel life, I finish my drink, say goodbye, and step out into the chilly London street with the whole of my undistinguished career stretching safely ahead of me. "Instead, you realize I don't know anything about politics," I said. "Well, you voted for him, didn't you?" "Well, of course I did. Everybody voted for him." "Well, that's the point." He glanced around. "Marty Reinhardt paid $10 million for these memoirs on the condition that they would be in the bookstores within 2 years. And from what I hear, he's nowhere near meeting that requirement. Reinhardt are getting frantic, and they're holding a beauty parade at their London office tomorrow morning. I promise you, it's a great opportunity for you, and the money will be good. The kids won't starve." "I don't have any kids." "No," said Rick with a wink. "But I do." We parted on the steps of the club. Rick had a car waiting outside with his engine running. "See you tomorrow," he said, and dramatically, in a puff of exhaust fumes, he was gone. Mephistopheles on a 15% commission. I was left in that narrow zone where Soho washes up against Covent Garden, a strip of empty theatres, dark alleys, red lights, snack bars and bookshops. I often drop into one to see how my titles are displayed, and that is what I did that afternoon. Once inside, it was a short step across the scuffed red carpet of the biography and memoir department, and suddenly I'd gone from celebrity to politics. I was surprised by how much they had on the former Prime Minister. An entire shelf. Everything from the early hagiography, Adam Lang, statesman for our time, to a recent hatchet job entitled Would You Adam and Eve It? The Collected Lies of Adam Lang. I bought myself a small pile of research material and headed out of the bookshop. It was obvious the moment I got outside that another bomb had gone off. At Tottenham Court Road, people were surging up above ground from all four exits of the tube station like stormwater from a blocked drain. A loudspeaker said something about an incident at Oxford Circus. It took me 2 full hours to walk home. Kate had already let herself in and was watching the news. Kate. I'd forgotten she was coming over for the evening. I kissed the top of her head, dropped the books onto the sofa and went into the kitchen to pour myself a whiskey. The entire tube is down. I've had to walk all the way from Covent Garden, I said. When I went back into the living room, she was removing one book after another from the carrier bag. What's all this? She said, looking up. And then she realised what was going on. No, oh, don't tell me they want you to ghost his book. Oh, you cannot be serious. Why, it'll probably come to nothing, I said, and drank some more whiskey. She went back to watching the news, only now with her arms tightly folded, always a warning sign. The ticker tape announced that the death toll was 7 and likely to rise. There was a time, said Kate slowly, after what felt like a very long silence, when princes taking their countries to war were supposed to risk their lives in battle. Now they travel around in bomb-proof cars with armed bodyguards and make fortunes 3,000 miles away while the rest of us are stuck with the consequences of their actions. I just don't understand you. She got up and went into the bedroom to collect the bag she always brought on the night she planned to stay. I heard her filling it noisily with lipstick, toothbrush, perfume spray. I knew if I went in, I could retrieve the situation, but the truth was, at that moment, given a choice between an evening of her smug, left-wing moralising and the prospect of working with a so-called war criminal, I preferred the war criminal. So I simply carried on staring at the television. Reinhardt Publishing UK consisted of 5 ancient firms acquired during a vigorous bout of corporate kleptomania in the 90s. Wrenched out of their Dickensian garrets in Bloomsbury, upsized, downsized, rebranded, renamed, reorganized, modernized, and merged, they had finally been dumped in Hounslow. In a steel and smoked glass office block with all its pipes on the outside. Quigley was waiting for me by the lifts. I have to tell you, he said as we rose to the penthouse floor, that I don't think you're the right man for this assignment. Well, then it's a good job it's not your decision, Roy, I said. The man who really ran the global show was waiting for us in the boardroom, John Maddox, chief executive of Reinhardt Inc. Next to him was Lang's Washington attorney, Sidney Kroll, a bespectacled 40-something with a delicate pale face and floppy raven hair. And Nick Riccardelli, I think you know, said Quigley, completing the introductions. My agent winked up at me. Hi, Rick, I said.
I gather from Rick you're aware of the situation and yet you know what we're looking for. Maddox began. So perhaps you could tell us exactly what you think you'd bring to this project.
Ignorance, I said brightly, which at least had the benefit of shock value. And before anyone could interrupt, I launched into the little speech I'd rehearsed in the taxi coming over. I'll be completely honest, I don't read political memoirs. So what? I shrugged. Nobody does. But actually, that's not my problem. I pointed at Maddox. That's your problem. Now, rumour has it you paid $10 million for this book, I went on. As things stand, how much of that do you think you're going to see back? $2 million? $3 million? Well, that's bad news for you. And that's especially bad news, I said, turning to Kroll, for your client. Because for him, this isn't about money. This is about reputation. This is Adam Lang's opportunity to speak directly to history, to get his case across. I know, in retrospect, what a huckster I sounded, but this was pitch talk, remember? Which, like declarations of undying love in a stranger's bedroom at midnight, shouldn't necessarily be held against you the next morning. I leaned forwards. You see, here's the joke. A leader's autobiography ought to be more interesting than most memoirs, not less. So I see my ignorance about politics as an advantage. I cherish my ignorance, quite frankly. Besides, Adam Lang doesn't need any help from me with the politics of this book. He's a political genius. What he does need, in my humble opinion, is the same thing a movie star needs, or a baseball player, or a rock star. An experienced collaborator who knows how to ask him the questions which will draw out his heart. There was a silence. I was trembling. Rick gave my knee a reassuring pat under the table. Nicely done.
What utter balls,
said Quigley.
Think so? Asked Maddox, still looking at me.
He said it in a neutral voice, but if I had been Quigley, I would have detected danger.
Oh, John, of course,
said Quigley, with all the dismissive scorn of four generations of Oxford scholars behind him.
Adam Lang is a world historical figure, and his autobiography is going to be a world publishing event. It shouldn't be approached like a feature for a celebrity magazine.
It seems to me, said Maddox, that I have entire warehouses full of world publishing events that I somehow can't figure out how to get off my hands. And a heck of a lot of people read celebrity magazines.
Well, maybe, said Rick, we could run over how you see this working practically.
First off, we need it wrapped up in a month, said Maddox. That's Marty's view as well as mine.
A month, I repeated. You want a book in a month. And everything will have to be done in the States, said Kroll. Adam's completely locked into a lecture tour there right now and a fundraising program for his foundation. I don't see him coming back to the UK till March at the earliest. I nodded slowly. I suppose I can always bring the manuscript back here to work on. The manuscript stays in America, said Kroll flatly. That's one of the reasons Marty made the house on the Vineyard available. It's a secure environment. Only a few people are allowed to handle it.
It sounds more like a bomb than a book, joked Quigley.
Nobody laughed. He rubbed his hands unhappily.
You know, I will need to see it myself at some point. I am supposed to be editing it.
In theory, said Maddox. Actually, we need to talk about that later.
He turned to Kroll.
We'll need to revise as we go.
As they carried on discussing the timetable, I studied Quigley. He was upright but motionless, like one of those victims in the movies who gets stuck with a stiletto while standing in a crowd and dies without anyone noticing. Yet even at the time, I realized he'd asked a perfectly reasonable question. If he was the editor, why shouldn't he see the manuscript? And why did it have to be held in a secure environment on an island off the eastern seaboard of the USA? I felt Rick's elbow in my ribs and realized Maddox was talking to me.
How soon can you get over there, assuming we go with you rather than one of the others? How fast can you move?
It's Friday today, I said. Give me a day to get ready. I can fly Sunday.
I start Monday? That will be great.
Maddox and Kroll looked at one another.
We'll go with you,
said Maddox.